Today's podcast session is supported by Upheal. So if you ask a therapist who's doing clinical work what the bane of their existence is, usually progress notes are in the top 1 to 2. I'm not naming any names, but when I was doing clinical work, I remember I had several colleagues who would get so backed up on clinical notes, so they would end up spending their nights and weekends trying just to catch up. Honestly, who wants to do that? And this is where Upheal comes in. Upheal is AI-powered case notes. Now, I know for many of us, when we hear the word AI, there's like a natural skepticism. And honestly, I had that skepticism as well until I got to meet with the Upheal team and learn about some of the many ways that they are doing this in a way that is HIPAA compliant and also doesn't sell data to anyone and also protects our clients as well. You can learn more about Upheal and the awesome work that they're doing in the world by going to sellingthecouch.com/Upheal. And Upheal is spelled U-P and then H-E-A-L, all one word. And at checkout, be sure to enter the promo code COUCH25, C-O-U-C-H, and the number 25 to get 25% off your Upheal plan for the first 2 months. Welcome to today's session of Selling the Couch. I'm your host, Dr. Melvin Varghese. My guest today is Eric Tivers. Eric is a licensed clinical social worker who's built a very successful private practice in Volo, Illinois, focused on ADHD and autism spectrum disorders. Eric and I are actually also podcasting friends. Eric is the host of the wildly successful ADHD Rewired podcast, where he talks about his own journey with ADHD and tips and tools and tricks that he's learned along the way to help succeed with ADHD.
ADHD Rewired, episode number 47. This is the show designed to help those of us who have really good intentions and a slightly wandering attention. My name is Eric Tivers. I'm a licensed clinical social worker, coach, and consultant.
In today's session of Selling the Couch, you'll learn how to alter that fear of starting out, how to network with colleagues, especially when you're starting in private practice, and how to leverage your past clinical experiences into creating and building a niche private practice.
We need systems for everything, truly everything, for time, for our memory, for inputting things, for capturing ideas. We need systems for our systems.
Here's my conversation with Eric Tivers from erictivers.com. Eric, welcome to Selling the Couch.
Thank you so much for having me.
Eric, let's start off with this question, which is, tell us a little bit about the story of how you started a private practice that specializes in ADHD and autism.
Sure. So the way I kind of started the practice was, I think a lot of ways how a lot of entrepreneurs get started with what they do is that they're kind of put into a corner, and now they have to fend themselves out. So for me, what that looked like, I was just recently got my license. I was working at an applied behavioral analysis clinic, working with kids with autism. And so I was doing that for about a year. There was a Monday that my wife and I, we closed on our home. So we now have a mortgage. On that Friday, I got laid off.
Oh, wow.
So part of that was out of necessity. So I knew I always wanted to do private practice. You know, that's I want to be my own boss. I always knew that. And right. That was part of my plan that was a little bit more in my mind. It was a longer term vision. But the decision to do it right then and there was kind of made pretty easy. Because knowing that I had a mortgage and no job, on my way home from getting laid off, I started making phone calls, networking, and I didn't really have time to panic. I needed to start doing this. And, you know, the way kind of my brain works is when I'm in that kind of situation, my brain gets really focused. Mm-hmm. So from the time I was laid off till the time I had my first client was 6 months. And then 6 months after that, I had I wouldn't say a full practice, but a relatively thriving practice.
It's an amazing story. It's like, how did you find that part? Like, you know, I feel like for any of us, when we're at a place where something completely unexpected happens, we either go one of two ways, right? Like, we either take that route of, like you said, getting extreme focus, or we just are paralyzed and we don't know what to do. Mm-hmm. How did you find that courage inside of you to, you know, go that route that you did?
Well, the thought of working for somebody else just seemed horrifying.
Right, especially after that, like, previous experience, right?
I mean, it's the thing is, so I'm a certified school social worker, but I learned through just my during grad school and the internships that I had that school social work was not for me. You know, there's tons of paperwork. I kind of half jokingly say that I have a pretty bad allergy to paperwork. I break out in piles in procrastination. And I know that in the schools, like, there's so much of that. I also know that in the schools that as a social worker, you're very much in a host setting. You know, you're in a sense, you're a guest in an educator's setting. And to really do things that are impactful, there's a lot of politics that are involved in that. And I'm someone that, you know, I have big ideas and I'm passionate about what I do. And I don't like to have to always bite my tongue in the sake of politics. So, you know, that's sort of when I think about why did I do private practice, is I couldn't think of doing anything else because I've done other things. You know, before I was working at this private clinic, I was I worked in residential. I was a clinical program manager for a residential group home in the nonprofit sector. And I was doing the job of three people. I mean, it was exhilarating in a lot of ways, and I really liked it. And I was working with a lot of kids with autism, more kind of severe autism. So I was dealing with a lot of kind of aggressive behaviors, and I was doing a lot of crisis management. I was doing a lot of training, which I did like, but it was just a lot. It was the reports that I had to write, there was just too much kind of paperwork, administrative work to it. So, you know, you asked me, you know, why did I focus on autism and ADHD? When I first started working with autism, I kind of got thrown into it. You know, I was working in a therapeutic day school, which also had a residential component to it as well. And I was working with kids that had emotional and behavioral challenges. And they started this autism program where they brought in basically these two kids from out of state who were in state hospitals and who would never gotten any kind of early intervention services. So these were kids that had some pretty profound needs. And I didn't know a thing about autism at the time. And so they asked me to come into this classroom to help. What they needed help was keeping these kids safe because they were having just, you know, these prolonged marathon tantrums where they were not being safe to themselves and others. They were trying to, you know, attack the staff. And to me, it just something clicked about it for me. It was very interesting to me. It engaged my brain. It was kind of exhilarating. And I loved it.
Right. There was like a different energy to it.
Yeah. Yeah. Where this, like, I'd never seen behavior like this. Mm. You know, I remember my first day in that classroom, this little girl I was working with. I mean, she truly had like an 8-hour tantrum. And it was. Mm. Sad. But I was looking at it from the perspective of what's going on in her brain that's causing these behaviors. I mean, I had never seen behaviors quite like this before. And so my first day there, she would be kind of walking towards me, had this sort of this look on her face. I wasn't sure what she was going to do. And she would go like, pizza, and then try to bite me. And I was like, what is going on? So, you know, I was totally engaged and intrigued by it. I dove into the research. And some of the things that I found were some parallels between, you know, how this autism was presenting and myself. And when I was in college, I learned that I had ADHD. which was I only discovered after I almost failed out of college. So, you know, I was thinking about what were the things that really triggered these kids that I was working with. Transitions were a big one. And while I wouldn't engage in self-injurious behavior when I transitioned, I wasn't good at transitioning. It would take me a long time to like get my stuff together. And I was always, you know, there was always one more thing I wanted to do. And so I recognized a lot of the similarities, even though there were a lot of also differences.
Right. There was a very personal component to it.
Yes. Yes.
How do you think those past experiences working in residential, how do you think that's informed you in the present as a private practitioner?
I think in a lot of ways. I think one, with working with autism, it helps me see where the whole spectrum is. Because I've worked with very kind of classic autism, nonverbal. I worked with some young adults who, you know, are functioning at like a 12-month-old level. I've also worked with individuals who are, I mean, just way smarter than I'll ever be, but have that social component where the rigidness to kind of what they do. So it really has helped me see the vastness of the spectrum. Mm. It helped me see it. I think when you look at the kind of spectrum of just human behavior, when you see all components of it, it gives you a deeper understanding for kind of both the function of behavior, and kind of what drives certain behaviors. It helped me see the things that, my clients tend to be more sensitive to. Helped me see, the potential and the sometimes hidden strengths in a lot of my clients that I work with. It's unfortunate we have this tendency to just look at problems through the deficit model. But I think it's so important to also look at the strengths, that an individual, brings, because those are also really important.
Right. I guess the thing I hear in that is like you actually got into the arena as opposed to like standing on the sideline, right? And I feel like what you're saying is all of those experiences in the past have really informed you and have made you more compassionate and have made you, I think, in the present now look more for solutions as opposed to always just seeing deficits.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing too is that I've seen is that for certain types of clients they'll reach out to me and I'll tell them, you know, I could help you, but I think that you probably need a whole team. Mm-hmm. So right now my practice is just me. So with certain clients, they need more of a team approach versus just an individual therapist approach. So that's been helpful for me to see, because I see that with some clients with autism, they don't always generalize information. So they need to see it from multiple perspectives, from multiple people, to be able to kind of gauge and understand kind of the big picture, to get the gist, to get the kind of that gestalt of what is being presented. Mm-hmm. But so when I was working at my last job, when I was laid off from, I was working with this as a 10-year-old client who was diagnosed with Asperger's, who was just I loved working with this kid. He was totally quirky, kind of nerdy, and I just loved him. Like, he was just really smart, and his parents were really smart. And when I was laid off, I decided that I want to model my entire practice like around this kid. Because I looked forward to working with him. He challenged me in a lot of ways. He was clever. He was quick-witted. He just had a way about him that I think it's, you know, one of the reasons I love working with kind of high-functioning clients with autism and Asperger's, is that it's, in some ways, it's the challenge of how do you out-clever the clever? Because in a lot of ways, their thinking style, it's based around this almost illogical logic in some ways.
It's really interesting. One of the things that you said earlier was right when you lost your job, right? Your first inclination was to get in the car and call and start networking.
Yes.
So what did you tell these people?
Well, what I first did is I called the therapist that I was working with, who was my supervisor when I was getting my supervision hours to sit for my licensing exam. So she was the first person that I reached out to. And I just said, like, here's my situation. What should I do? And so she gave me the name and number of a social worker that was kind of a mentor to her. And so I went and met with this person, and he gave me one piece of advice that I think was so simple and yet so impactful, that was truly extraordinarily helpful in building my practice. And what it was a very just kind of strategic strategy, and that was: get a map, put yourself in the center, draw a circle around the area that you're willing to, that you want to kind of get clients from. Now go meet everyone in that area that does similar things that you do, and just talk to them and kind of see what they're doing. See, you know, how you can support them. See if there's where those kind of services are needed. And you know, I didn't necessarily take that his advice to be full capacity, but I probably met with about 10 different practice owners in the area, and that was so helpful because, you know, one thing led to another. Where I just was able to kind of build it from there. So that was really helpful for me. And the other thing is that he really emphasized to me is pick up the phone and talk to people. Mm. And, you know, I hate the phone. I have totally irrational anxiety about picking up the phone. And, you know, we get behind this kind of safety of, you know, I can do everything online. You know, the way I kind of think about it is, when you're looking at websites and resources, the information that is there is based on what somebody, a person, decided and prioritized what is relevant to put, you know, on that website. But you can have access to the full information that person put on that website by talking to the person.
Yeah, right. It gives you more information.
Yes. And I just found that even with having a little bit of anxiety picking up the phone, I just, in a very kind of mindful way, just acknowledged the anxiety and picked up the phone anyways. And it was really helpful. And what I found, I think with all except for one person that I interacted with, people were very willing to help and give information and share resources with. You know, I think out of all the people I met with, I had one person that just kind of seemed sort of protective of, you know, they're like, why do you want this information? I'm very protective of my information, you know? So, and that's going to happen anywhere, but you know, people I found they were very willing to share and to help.
Yeah. I mean, in many ways we're in such a great profession because I do feel like the vast majority of people are genuinely, they want to help, they're caring, they're sincere. How do you think, just shifting a little bit, how do you think having, your passion for ADHD and autism, how do you think that's impacted some of the risks that you've taken in building out your practice now?
So, you know, it's, you definitely hit the nail on the head. It's a passion, you know, this is a passionate thing for me. You know, this is not just something that I've gone and got clinical training in, you know, and in fact, most of what I know about, autism and ADHD was from seeking out information, going to conferences, you know, reading all this information kind of on my own, because there is very little specific training in these areas professionally. So I kind of dove in very deeply. You know, for me, growing up with undiagnosed ADHD and then learning that I had ADHD after I almost failed out of college, you know, that experience was hugely impactful. You know, because the labels that I was given growing up, it was lazy, unmotivated, didn't care. I could do it if I just applied myself. And you know, this is the story that so many of my clients have been hearing their entire lives, or the story that their parents or teachers think about their kids or their students. And when I understood that it was this thing called ADHD, and I got that diagnosis and I started taking medication for it. And, you know, there's this experience that it's hard to explain, but people that have had similar experiences relate to it. And that's feeling normal for the first time.
Yeah, that's almost that medication. Like, well, when you were saying this, like, I just got the word like it was liberating.
Yes, it was liberating. It was so there. Then came this kind of dive into self-awareness, So at the time, so my freshman year, I was a sort of undecided communications major. I was taking some classes in marketing and advertising, and I liked the creative piece to it, but there was so much kind of technical writing involved in it. And I'm not that great of a writer. I struggle with it. My brain kind of moves too fast to keep up with my speed of writing. And to be able to organize my thoughts in writing is always a struggle. So I switched my major because I got basically all D's in communication courses. I figured that wasn't going to work. I switched my major to social work. And even the stuff that most people say are the boring social work classes that you have to just kind of get through, I loved it. You know, when we're even just like the ethics courses, you know, that the policy course, I was really interested in it because, you know, I've always been a why person, a person that wants deeper understanding and looking at problems from a philosophical perspective. It's like, don't just tell me what to do. Let's talk about why we're doing it.
And I
found that in social work.
Right. It fit more. I think it lined up with more who you were as a person.
Yes. Yes. And then so during that time that I just got that diagnosis and I was just taking a couple introduction to social work courses, I was introduced to this concept called the Johari's window. Are you familiar with this concept?
No, I haven't heard of it. I'm curious.
So it has to do with self-awareness. If you can imagine a four square grid and one of the squares is the awareness that you have, but only you have. So, you know, private thoughts, secret desires, things that other people don't know. Okay. In another area, region of this grid, you have things that other people know about you and think about you, but you don't know about yourself. And this is what is called the blind spot. And as I often tell my clients, this is the area that we typically work on in therapy and coaching. Then we have the area that is known to you and others, kind of the public arena, right? And then there's the furthest corner, which is the part of yourself that is not known to you and is not known to others. And so that might be strengths that you haven't discovered yet. That might be things, you know, it's kind of – a lot of it has to do with the future, but it's just the unknowable, right? The to be discovered. So this was a really impactful thing for me because I just got this diagnosis that explained so much, and yet I had so much more I really needed to learn. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was this experience of, you know, I used to not like reading at all. It was very frustrating for me because what would happen is I would read something and within a page, something I was reading would trigger a thought, and then that thought would trigger another thought. Now I'm still reading, but I'm not thinking about what I'm reading. I'm thinking about all the other thoughts that are being triggered by the original thought.
Right.
And I didn't even realize that this was happening. So I get to an end of a chapter and I had no comprehension of what I actually read. And so that first experience of taking medication, I remember I was reading one of my textbooks and I got all the way through the chapter. And I just remember like pausing and realizing that I know exactly what I just read. Like I retained it and I was thinking about it. And I remember sitting in my room crying because it was so impactful to me. It's like, this is what was, you know, why school was so hard for me, you know, growing up, and why I struggled so much through a lot of schooling. And so I realized that, oh, you know, it's like, I'm not stupid. I'm not lazy. You know, it's my brain just has a hard time regulating its attention to things that are either detail oriented or uninteresting. So, you know, the importance of doing things that you're interested in for somebody with ADHD, I look at that as a necessity, not a luxury.
Yeah. I mean, just that story, I don't know. I teared up like just hearing it because, you know, just how, I don't know. I just feel like you must be quite amazing with your clients because of everything that you've gone through. I feel like that's what makes for such great clinicians, you know, the ability to really put ourselves in the shoes of another, or at least to be able to relate on some level.
And, you know, and I've seen the impact it can have. When I was in grad school, I, you know, this whole idea of self-awareness, and then self-advocacy, you know, is, because self-awareness is not just how do we know ourselves, but it's how do we know how other people see us. That is so critically important. And so understanding the importance of this, when I was in grad school, I was doing my research was on teaching self-awareness, self-advocacy skills, and self-determination to students who had you know, various disabilities, who had an IEP. Okay. And so I did this program in an eighth grade classroom, cross-categorical classroom, and it was to teach them about the nature of their disability, kind of why they were in the classroom that they were in. And can I tell you what the most common, when I did my baseline kind of survey, the most common reason that the students said for why they were in this classroom?
No, what is it?
That they were retarded. And, that, you know, that's heartbreaking.
Right.
You know, when I asked them if they knew what was in their IEP, the most common answer was, what's an IEP? So over the course of 8 weeks, we went through kind of what this all means. And I did a lot of role playing with them. And, you know, I'm all about shock value because I think it catches our attention and it kind of awakens our senses. So, you know, I was talking to the students about, you know, I asked the students who would rather in front of their friends look like they're, you know, kind of quote unquote bad versus dumb. And all the kids said they'd rather look bad and dumb. So I said, let's play out how this looks like when you have a challenge with reading. So the teacher calls on you to read and you're stuttering through and struggling through. You're sounding out each word and you hear the snickering around you and you feel embarrassed and ashamed. So what do you do? You don't sit there and say, you know, teacher, I'm really struggling with reading. You know, right. So maybe I should come and get help from you. What do? Is you knock over the desk and you storm out of the classroom. And so I did this and I demonstrated that. And that knowing look that all the students had in that moment was,
Yeah, like you've put it in a language that they could understand.
And so we talked about, yes, there are certain things that may be hard. But here's the strengths that you have. So we kind of look at different learning styles, and we talked about different, you know, kind of celebrities who have different forms of disabilities and have ADHD and dyslexia, and they really resonated with that. You know, most students at that age, you know, want to be awesome and want to be a celebrity, and you know, it's so when they realize, oh, there are these well known people who also have these challenges, it felt kind of okay, and I shared with them my own story, and so it's learning how to advocate for themselves, and by the end of this 8 week group, I taught them how to run their own IEP meeting.
Wow, that's really neat. That is, I mean, it's just really, really neat. Why don't we make that transition to the Hotcakes round? How does that sound?
All right, let's do it.
All right. What's a daily habit that you believe contributes to your private practice success?
Planning. Every day I have a notebook that I use to plan. I will transfer my daily appointments into there. I have my big items of things, the projects that I'm working on. So I've kind of created my own system that's constantly evolving, but it's intentional planning. I do not walk into my office without a plan. And if I go to my office without my plan, I will actually sit outside of my office door before actually walking into my office to take that time and make that plan. Cause otherwise I will be responding to what is right in front of me, which is often not my priority items.
What's an online resource that's been invaluable in your private practice journey?
Online resources that's been invaluable to my private practice journey. There's a lot. I think just being out is in many places as you can be. My website has been helpful. I would say I'm blanking right now on this answer.
No problem. I mean, I think the website's a great one.
You know? Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that the standard psychology today has been helpful for getting referrals. You know, where I'm at now, Facebook has been amazing. I have some Facebook groups that I'm doing. But that's more in the kind of the coaching realm.
Right. Neat. What's your favorite business-related book?
my favorite business related book, and I've read a few recently that have been really kind of stirring around in my head. I actually listened to the, and it's not, you know, a business related book per se, but it relates very much to my business. And that's Brené Brown's, The Power of Authenticity, or I'm sorry, The Power of Vulnerability. And to me, that kind of just validated what I'm doing. You know, Think and Grow Rich, I thought it was very helpful just for positive mindset. And then I remember reading back in the day when I first started the How to Build and Grow a Successful Thriving Practice, I believe is the name of the book.
All good ones. What's one tip that you would give to someone who's thinking about starting a private practice?
Get a map.
I feel like we drilled that in this session. Imagine that you were starting your private practice journey all over again. You have $500 in your laptop. What is the first step that you would take toward building your private practice?
I would do what I did. Again, you know, one of the things that I didn't mention that I did was I went out to a lot of different support groups that were in, you know, for autism, ADHD, and I gave presentations. I gave a lot of presentations. And I have to say that, especially in the beginning and still probably now, giving local presentations is my probably the top driver for referrals for my practice. So I would say I would definitely repeat that and probably even do more of it.
And Eric, you are off the hot couch.
It's so cozy and comfy here, though.
People keep saying that. Eric, what are the best ways that folks can get in touch with you?
Best ways is my website. Let me give you my the website for my podcast that we didn't really have a chance to mention. But I have a podcast called ADHD Rewired. It's basically, it's a podcast that is stories, strategies, and kind of just tips for being successful with ADHD, but also kind of going through that journey of acceptance. So the website's ADHDrewired.com, which is just a landing page for my main website, which is erictivers.com. That's really the best way to contact me. I have contact forms on there if you want to reach out to me.
Yeah, I definitely will put that in the show notes. Eric, thank you so much for joining us, and I really enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Hope you enjoyed that conversation with Eric Tivers. You know, as I think about most of these podcast sessions, especially when I have therapists on, one of the themes that keeps coming up is that sense of fear. And when a clinician makes that choice to start in private practice, a lot of times that overwhelming sense and that crippling sense of fear that comes. And I think sometimes what can happen to us is we get that sense of fear and then it almost becomes a sense of paralysis. But then even more than that, we then try to figure out what to do with it. And we spend so much time in our minds that we actually never take action, sort of this idea of paralysis by analysis. And I really just respect Eric a lot. And I was thinking about him sitting there and, you know, having lost his job and what that was like, and then realizing he had to do something different. And the reality is, you know, for me, like I've realized that first hurdle of actually taking action, of doing something that's outside of your comfort zone, that's often the hardest one. And then once you've actually taken that step and done it, the subsequent ones become a lot easier. For today's show notes, as well as some of the resources that Eric mentioned, please find those at sellingthecouch.com/session and the numbers 2-1. Thank you, everyone, and have a great week.
Thanks for listening to the Selling the Couch podcast. For more great content and to stay up to date, visit www.sellingthecouch.com.
So
So if you've been listening to the STC podcast for a while, or you've been listening to podcasts and you've had this thought of, Mel, I would love to launch my own podcast in order to grow my business, just wanted to encourage you to check out our free podcasting workshop, which is over at sellingthecouch.com/podcasting workshop. You can basically sign up at a day and a time that works for you. It's 90 minutes. And when I do these workshops or when I record them, I truly believe in quality teaching, so it's going to be well worth your time. We're going to go through gear recommendations and how to launch strategically and how to think about monetizing your podcast and how to line up your podcast with your existing offers and how to do it strategically and authentically and not salesy and slimy and all of those things. So again, the link is over at sellingthecouch.com/podcasting workshop.